My colleagues with the flying squad will love this one. Nailing Jimmy Robertson will be a coup.
There's more, Inspector Caldwell. I just had to get them into safe hands. What about Teddy Wickham?
Steps have been taken to question him. His testimony will come in useful to snare his uncle, though he will most likely end up being reassigned to another military capacity, and that's after a good spell of cleaning latrines before being promoted to peeling spuds and chopping cabbage. And after that, he won't be in any cushy number like looking after stores.
He shook his head.
The forces have lost enough men, and they can't afford to lose more, so they're making allowances.
He sighed.
Anyway, getting Jimmy Robertson off the streets will be a dream come true for us at the Yard. Trouble is, the nasty bugger gets others to do his dirty work, so he's hard to nail. But this time, it's his family telling us the story.
He turned to get into the motor car.
I'll see you at the Yard to make a full statement.
And what about Joe Coombs' killer?
Got Murphy on it, down in Basingstoke. Should be picking him up at any minute. How did you know it was him?
It was a process of elimination. Freddie Mays had a lot to lose. With Joe being so ill, and him worried more people would notice, and then the balloon would really go up. Mike Yates, Freddie, they're all Jimmy Robertson's men, one way or another.
The money way, said Caldwell.
The past 10 years have been bad for a lot of people. No work to be had, and even when you get a job, you're not being paid as much, or you're on short time. I would bet that Freddie had more going on at home than we know about, and responsibility brings a need for more money. I have no idea who Jimmy Robertson's driver is, but I imagine he was the man with the cash, and Freddie just knew the route that Joe took when he was out for a walk, trying to clear his head. He was an accomplice, not the perpetrator.
We found the motor and the driver. He's got previous as long as your arm, including grievous bodily harm. Good old GBH. In fact, on his record, there's a long line of GBH. GBH and even more GBH. His name's Sidney Spooner. The initials suit him. He should be over there with old Hitler.
Caldwell paused, then inclined his head toward the back seat of the motor car.
And what about their parents? I'm looking forward to hearing their side of the story.
Can I talk to them first? Asked Maisie. Caldwell nodded.
All right. This time, yes. I owe you.
Maisie watched as Caldwell moved away. His rhetoric was the same, but it was tempered, flat as if someone had stepped hard upon an essential and not entirely likable part of his character. And such was the air of melancholy that emanated from him, underlined by his willingness to follow her lead, that she reached out to touch his shoulder. Inspector Caldwell, wait. There's something amiss. She kept her voice low as he stepped back to face her. What is it? What's wrong? Caldwell shook his head.
I don't like to admit it, but there's not much anyone can get past you, is there, Miss Dobbs?
He took a deep breath, looking up at the barrage balloons, then casting his eyes down to the sandbags and barbed wire. He exhaled as he brought his attention back to Maisie.
It's Abel. You remember Abel?
Yes, of course I remember. You said he joined the Navy. Caldwell nodded.
He did. And I made a joke of that, too. Abel. Seaman Abel. That's what I said when he joined up. And the lad took it all in good heart.
Caldwell looked at his feet, then at Maisie again.
HMS Keith went down on Saturday. She came under attack by German aircraft, taking out her steering gear first. Then they dropped a bomb right down her funnel. And she'd already done one run to Dunkirk, evacuating over 900 soldiers. She was on her way back to get more when they attacked her. A lot of men were saved. But Abel wasn't one of them.
I am so sorry, Inspector. I'm so very sorry.
I feel bad about it, the way I teased him. Made everyone laugh at his expense.
Maisie shook her head. Don't blame yourself for anything. Abel was a good sport, and even though you ribbed him, he would smile a laugh in return. You noticed him, Inspector. Even though you had a joke about his name, he was never invisible, and was held with great affection by the other men because of the way he took it. I believe he knew it, too. Knew he was popular, and well-liked.
Thank you, Miss Dobbs. Thank you very much for that. Now then, I'd better get these two over to the yard before they kill each other in the back of my motor car.
Maisie watched the vehicle drive away.
I heard that about Abel. Terrible shame, said Billy, who had been waiting outside the cafe for Maisie. Miss, did you really mean it? About Abel knowing he was held with affection by Caldwell? I mean, does that man hold anyone in any sort of affection?
Maisie raised a hand to hail a taxicab. He was a good assistant to Caldwell, and though Caldwell could be merciless in his teasing, Abel had a gentle kindness about him, and I believe he would see no advantage to saying anything that would add to Caldwell's grief and guilt. A taxi stopped, allowing Maisie and Billy to climb aboard.
So, why do you think someone like Abel joined the police in the first place, if he was that gentle? I mean, you really need to be a bit of a tough nut to do that job, unless, of course, you're on the beat in a little village somewhere.
I don't really know. And by the way, from my experience, being on the beat in a village can be fraught with danger. But I would imagine that if we delved a bit further into his motivations, it might have something to do with his father. Perhaps he was a policeman, and even in a small village, a man who aspired to Scotland Yard and pressed his son into the same profession. Perhaps when war was declared, the Navy offered a way out of the family business for Abel, so he jumped at the chance of enlisting into the senior service. She paused. It's all perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. And on that note, talking about a family business, we're going to see Phil and Sally Coombs. Maisie and Billy sat in the saloon bar and waited until afternoon closing time before the pub was empty. Phil Coombs did not even ask if they wanted to speak to him, but as he chivied the last customer out of the pub and locked the door, he turned to them.
"Better come upstairs. Sally will have heard me bolt the door and the kettle will be on."
"Thank you, Mr. Coombs," said Maisie. Sally Coombs demonstrated no sense of surprise as her husband led the visitors into her kitchen. She set two more cups and saucers, a pot of tea, a jug of milk, and the sugar bowl on the table.
"Take a seat," said Coombs. "You too," he added, pulling out a chair for his wife.
Maisie looked in silence from Phil to Sally Coombs, and Billy shifted in his seat. "You know why I'm here, don't you?" said Maisie.
"It's about my brother," said Sally.
She pulled a handkerchief from her pinafore pocket and pressed it against her eyes.
"We couldn't go to the police," said Coombs, putting an arm around his wife's shoulder.
"Couldn't go to the police? He was killing your son."
Billy's outburst came without warning.
"Billy!"
Maisie raised her hand to settle her assistant. She drew her attention back to Phil Coombs. "Mr. Coombs, Phil, correct me if I'm wrong, but here's what I believe has happened in this family." She looked toward Sally.
"Would you pour the tea, Mrs. Coombs? I know I could do with a cup."
She continued while Sally Coombs poured.
"Sometimes these things start in a small way, don't they? I've seen this so many times in my work. The very worst trouble that people get into doesn't begin with a big leap to the dark side. It's rather like when you run a hot water tap. It first runs cold, then slowly the water warms, until the hot water comes through, and it's so uncomfortable you have to draw your hand away. You can run the cold water to moderate the heat, or you can just get used to the increasing temperature."
Sally Coombs set a cup of tea, each in front of Maisie, Billy, and her husband, then took a sip from her own cup while continuing to stare at Maisie, as if she had been anticipating every word spoken.
Phil, you were in the army with Jimmy Robertson, and you two became tight. He's a charismatic person, after all. I've heard he's a bit of a jack-the-lad, with a quick turn of phrase and a very good head on his shoulders. A very bright man.
He kept our boys out of the army, said Sally.
Indeed. Maisie glanced at Billy, then brought her attention back to Sally. She had expected her to make at least one defense of her brother.
And he's seen you all right, she continued. You've been well taken care of as a family.
But there's a price, isn't there? And what was that price? Selling his stolen goods through the pub. Perhaps the holiday clubs? People put money in the kitty every week to buy themselves a good Christmas or Easter, and you not only keep it for them, but then you can sell the goods acquired by your brother.
It didn't do anyone any harm, said Sally, folding her arms.
Sal, hold on, said Coombs. All right, yes, it was just like you said. A bit of knocked-off stuff here and there, and holding on to some money until one of his blokes came for it. He made it worth our while. Kept our three in better clothes than we could afford, and all we had to do was the odd favour. Nothing wrong with that, not really.
But it began to get bigger, until I suspect you both would really rather not be doing what you were doing any more. And that's why when Joe didn't telephone as usual, and when he complained about the headaches, you were too scared to go to Jimmy, because really... Maisie turned her attention to Sally Coombs. Because really, you know that Jimmy might have the veneer of taking care of his own, but anyone in his pay is dispensable one way or another. You could not go to the police directly, because you have, whether you like it or not, committed the crime of receiving stolen goods, and you've done it for years, probably all your life. Maisie reached to take a sip of tea, choosing her words. You, Phil, started the ball rolling when you came to see me. I think you hoped that I would find Joe alive, bring him home, and then all would be well. But I also think that in the deepest place of your heart, you knew your brother-in-law would sacrifice your son to save himself. He is a ruthless man. Phil Coombs began to weep, his shoulders shaking as the mournful keening took over his body.
I thought Jimmy was saving him. I thought he had helped us by putting in the word at Yates, and then getting him the job there. I knew that if this war went on, he'd reach conscription age. And after what I saw in the last war, I didn't want my sons to go. And Jimmy helped.
Sally's voice was cold, her words delivered in a tone that made Maisie think of shards of shaved ice.
Jimmy expects loyalty.
I'm sure he does. I think it's something we all like, but you knew deep down that something was not quite right with the work, and instead of allowing Joe to leave Mike Yates's employ, and Yates is in the palm of your brother's hand, you forbade him to take up the opportunity to work on a farm.
You're right, Miss Dobbs.
As he spoke, Maisie could see that Phil Coombs wore the demeanour of a resigned man. His shoulders were rounded, his head low, and in his voice she could feel the deep chasm of grief in his heart.
I was scared, and I was scared of Jimmy, of what he could do. I knew he would have had no patience if Joe's complaints led to him losing money. Archie and Vivian know exactly what their uncle is like, and they've towed the line. They've done very well, but Joe was different. He didn't really see it. And what future is there on a farm for a London boy?
Phil Coombs held out his hands, palms up, as he asked the question.
There's life, said Billy. A boy on a farm would be alive, and in one of your precious reserved occupations.
Maisie cleared her throat.
Billy, would you telephone Caldwell? Tell him Mr. and Mrs. Coombs are ready to make a statement. I think it would be a good idea if he sent a motor car.
Right you are, miss, said Billy.
He left the room to go down to the saloon bar, where he could place the call.
"I could have stopped it all if I'd gone to the police earlier," said Phil. "But, I mean, it was only headaches, and it was probably his age."
Maisie leaned forward, her brow knitted. "Phil, you're playing a devastating game of snakes and ladders, going back and forth with the truth. One minute you're confessing, and the next denying complicity to the rest of the world. You must face up to the fact that Joe suffered terrible pain due to your brother-in-law tampering with the paint he was supplying to Yates, and who knows how many others have been affected."
"But Teddy said..."
began Sally. "Teddy is only protected now because he is in uniform, and the services need people working, not in prison. But he may still risk incarceration if he has to stand a court-martial. The authorities know he was under the influence of a man of whom he was fearful, so that may help him. Believe it or not, the police have spoken up for him. But you knew Teddy worked in his uncle's warehouses before the war, and it was fortuitous that his experience took him right into a similar position with the RAF, looking after stores. But was it fortune or another of his uncle's contacts? Either way, that's where Jimmy Robertson came in again, and Teddy wasn't safe in the RAF.
"What do you mean?" asked Sally.
"Teddy was falsifying deliveries. No less than a third of each shipment was going straight to his uncle's warehouse, and a good deal of each shipment was foodstuff, which is becoming harder to get already. It's very nice money for Jimmy, a quite significant black market income. There's probably food in your larder that should have gone into an RAF store. Sally, your brother has tentacles that reach everywhere. But you know that. You've lived with it all your life, because your father before him was the same. It's the family business."
"We wanted only the best for our children, Miss Dobbs," said Phil Coombs. "We might have been strict. We might have been a bit hard on them. But it's no good bringing them up soft, is it? And we provided for them the best we could."
Maisie sighed, relieved to hear the sound of a motor car pulling up outside. It was not Caldwell who entered the kitchen moments later, but another man, along with Billy, and a uniformed policeman. The man in civilian clothing addressed Maisie first.
"Harry Bream, Flying Squad, pleased to meet you."
He turned to Phil and Sally Coombs.
"If you wouldn't mind accompanying me, Mr. and Mrs. Coombs. It's very quiet outside, and we just want to take you along to our gaff to ask a few questions."
Sally Coombs came to her feet, aided by her husband.
"If you don't mind, Mr. Bream, in fact, I'm sure it's Detective Inspector Bream, I'd like to change into my best costume, fetch my coat, and pay a visit to the lavatory," said Sally.
She smiled at her husband and reached across to squeeze his hand. Bream stepped aside to allow her to leave, and as she did so, Maisie came to her feet and stood still, watching the first step she took across the threshold onto the landing. As Sally Coombs's footfall receded along the passageway first to the bedroom, and then a few minutes later to the bathroom, Maisie felt as if she were watching a moving picture reduced to slow motion. And then the screen turned black.
"Oh, no!"
cried Maisie, rushing down the passageway. She had just pushed open the bathroom door when the shot rang out. Chapter 18. Maisie bent her head as the flash from camera bulbs erupted and reporters approached, notebooks in hand, asking for comments on what had happened in the private residence of the popular watering hole. Billy raised his hand to shield his employer, taking Maisie by the arm and falling into step as she walked at speed along Warren Street toward Fitzroy Square. Behind her, she could hear Jack Barker, the newspaper vendor, who had hurried across the street when he saw what was happening.
Come on, gents. That's enough for today. You've got your pictures and you've got the story. Now get back to your little desks down there in Fleet Street and fiddle with your pens, because I've got to sell your wares tomorrow morning.
That's all I need, said Maisie, as they reached the front door, her key at the ready.
Nearly there, miss. Another nice cup of tea with a lot of sugar is what we need. Terrible day, miserable day all around. And that was a blooming horrible thing you saw in there.
Maisie was standing by the window, staring down at Walter Miles's garden, when Billy entered her office, placing a tray with two mugs of hot tea on the long table, the case map still drawn out across its full length.
I know you prefer a mug, miss, so I didn't mess around with them china cups. Reminds me of being in the army, that there's still a fight to be had, and we'd better drink it all up and get some courage in us.
Maisie took a seat at the table, clutching the mug with both hands as she sipped the piping hot, sweet tea.
Funny, isn't it, miss? How it's a nice warm afternoon out there, but now we're both feeling like it's a winter's morning.
It's the adrenaline, Billy. The rush of adrenaline that gets you through a shock, leaves you cold once it diminishes in your body. At least we can still be shocked. I would hate to have to accept the death of Sally Coombs as something perfectly normal.
I know what you mean.
He put down the mug and tapped the map.
I can see all the links now, but some still seem a bit faint.
He paused.
And I've a question, miss, if you don't mind me asking.
Go on, Billy. We should sit here and talk over everything that's happened so we can begin to take it all in, along with the outcome. This has been a testing case.
It's been an odd one, no two ways about it. All these threads and lines of inquiry, and you're not the one tying them all together. Well, you were when it came to Sally Coombs, but...
Billy reached for his mug again.
Anyway, I don't want to speak out of turn.
Maisie looked up at the man who had been at her side as her assistant for the best part of 11 years, a man she had seen struggle with lingering pain from war wounds sustained in 1917, with addiction, the loss of a beloved child, a very ill wife, and the challenges of bringing two sons to manhood as war approached. In turn, he had witnessed Maisie battle her own shell shock, along with the physical wounds of war, and then her blossoming when finding love again. He had known her through widowhood, through a homecoming from another war, and had returned to work for her as she re-established her business. You have every right to express your opinions, Billy, and if I am not mistaken, you have been harboring feelings about the way I've managed this case.
It's just not like you. You've almost got there. You've all your notes from the investigation. You've got this.
He tapped the case map.
And you've handed the lot over to Caldwell and that bloke from the Sweeney Todd, Harry Bream. You're not going to be on the spot when they bring in Freddy What's-His-Name, and you never faced up to Jimmy Robinson, never even attempted to see him. That's not like you at all. Now, admittedly, being in the same room with that felon would be a bit of a chance. After all, he's not known for taking prisoners, but still. Why? Why aren't you in it at the end? Is it because you've not got the motor car anymore and you can't exactly nip here and there on the train and the bus? Or is it to do with the money? Because as far as I can see, there ain't some fancy client fallen over himself to settle an account on this one. All the costs are down to the business.
Maisie took another sip of tea before responding. Certainly giving up the Alvis has clipped my wings. It's hard to act at speed without a motor car, and it's not the money, Billy. I dare say there will be some consideration coming from Scotland Yard. After all, I've given them almost everything they need to make arrests, or I will have by the time we make our statements. And there are funds in the business account to absorb a few losses. She sighed. No, it's something quite different. I have to be careful for another reason.
I reckon after all this time, miss, you could tell me what it is, said Billy.
Maisie set down her mug, pushed back her chair and walked to the window, her eyes drawn to the thriving clematis. She lifted a hand to wipe away a tear, and turned back to Billy, leaning against the windowsill as she sighed, before beginning to explain herself. "You're right. Together we've put all the pieces on the table for Scotland Yard, and yet I am not the one constructing the final picture. Though it's pretty obvious, it will fall into place without any more help from me. But, Mish, wait, Billy, just wait." She cleared her throat. "You've probably gathered, indeed, I think it's fairly obvious, that I have become very fond of our little evacuee, Anna."
"She's a treasure of a child, a real treasure," said Billy.
"She is, indeed." Maisie nodded, struggling to swallow the lump in her throat. "And whilst her late grandmother, just before she passed away, signed forms naming me as Anna's guardian, my stated responsibility was not only to offer Anna a good home, but to find her a family who loved her. My role was to be temporary, a place for her to be safe until she could be settled forever. It's implied in the language." Billy opened his mouth to speak, but Maisie raised her hand and shook her head. "Let me get to the end, Billy." She took another deep breath. "I decided to take steps to adopt Anna, to become her mother. But of course there are hurdles to leap across. I have managed to persuade the authorities that it would be nigh on impossible to find her Maltese father. At first they stipulated that I should prove that both parents had relinquished interest, either through death or a signed contract, and then, without any prompting from me, they concluded that it might be difficult to place her, as she is not exactly coloured like an English rose. But neither am I. And I have had very mixed feelings, because on one hand I was glad they identified a problem with placing her, which gives weight to my application, yet at the same time I was filled with anger that they dared to voice such prejudice." She sighed, shaking her head. "And I couldn't exactly take them to task for it. That would have definitely put someone's back up, and I need people on my side, not against me. To the good, I have been fortunate in the references I've been able to submit, but two things stand in the way."
"Just two?" said Billy.
Maisie nodded. "Oh, but they're big. One is that I am a widow, though I am a woman of independent means, and of course I have a title bestowed upon me by marriage that has smoothed the way a little." She shook her head. "But to tell you the truth, that infuriates me too. I was brought up by people who, when all is said and done, did their very best for me. No matter what privations we faced as a family, I was loved. That's all that really matters. Anyway, my references are excellent, and my house passes muster with the Ministry of Health."
"So one thing is that you're a widow, a woman with no husband."
Maisie nodded, wiping away a tear.
"And what's the other thing?"
There was a moment's silence before Maisie could speak.
"My work."
"Oh," said Billy, nodding his understanding.
"Yes, I'm beginning to get the picture."
"So you see, I have to box clever, as the saying goes. I cannot be identified as being at the closure of a case, for example. You know how the press have reported it in the past, that I have been involved in an investigation. That's why I could only go so far with Vivian and Archie, why I could not go to challenge Jimmy Robertson. I'm worried enough at how reports of Sally Coombs's suicide might look in tomorrow's papers."
"What do they like about it? Your job? You're doing something decent and good, not like some people. And it's to do with justice, after all, and helping put wrong things right."
"First of all, it's the danger inherent in the work, and we know it carries a risk even though we are careful enough. And then there's the fact that I am likely to come into contact with a criminal element of society."
"But if it's dangerous, What do they think of you joining the auxiliary ambulance service as a volunteer? That's bleeding dangerous too. Or haven't you told them?
I've declared my involvement in volunteer work with the ambulance service, but that's seen as me doing my bit as a citizen. And we've all been called upon to do our voluntary service, haven't we? And they don't see that as dangerous at the present time. They don't even mind the fact that I spend several days per week in London, though that may have to change.
These people make me ill. Can't see to the ends of their noses. And what about little Anna? Bless her.
She's very happy. She adores Dad and Brenda. And even Lady Rowan and Lord Julian have started treating her as if she were the grandchild they always wanted.
Can't they speak up for you?
They provided my first references.
And I suppose there's a pen pusher somewhere who doesn't want to feel pushed around by the upper classes.
Something of that order.
Blimey.
Billy finished his tea and placed his mug on the tray.
So what are you going to do?
I'm going to keep my nose clean, so to speak. I can continue my work, though I will have to be careful, not do anything to draw attention to myself. I have never liked it on those occasions when my name has appeared either as a special witness in published court proceedings or the newspapers. I've tried to remain as anonymous as possible, but I admit, in terms of securing new business, it's useful. Anyway, a hearing has been set for September. I'll have to go before a panel, which includes a special judge, to state my case for becoming Anna's adoptive parent. I almost dare not hope.
Oh, miss, it'll all come out in the wash. That's what my old mum used to say. Just you wait and see.
Billy moved to Maisie's side and put an arm around her, pulling her to him as she wept.
You have a good old cry. It'll do you good. What with everything that's gone on lately and seeing Sally Coombs top herself today. Let your tears fall and then come out fighting. It'll be all right.
Oh, I hope so, Billy. I do hope so. I don't want to lose her.
Oh, no, miss. Oh, no.
I love Anna, Billy. I love her as if she were my own.
But she is. She is yours. Anyone who sees you two together knows that. She belongs with you. If your Dr. Blanche were here, I reckon he would say she always belonged to you.
Maisie slumped down onto one of the wicker lawn chairs without even entering her garden flat in Holland Park. There were telephone calls to be made, for her day's work was not yet done, and she was anxious to find out if Tim was improving. Every time she thought of her beloved godson, she felt her breath catch. She wondered how he might be feeling, now that the enormity of his undertaking and the loss of his best friend was in all likelihood beginning to come into focus. She allowed herself another 5 minutes outside before opening the French doors wide for the fresh evening air to blow through. She removed her jacket and hat and placed her document case and shoulder bag on top of the desk in the corner. Once again, she had left the office without her gas mask. She was just about to sink into the armchair when the telephone began to ring. She lifted the receiver.
"Tante Maisie, thank goodness! Where is everyone? I can't find my parents or my brothers. Have they all trotted off on holiday?"
"Tom, Tom, I'm so relieved to hear your voice. Your mother and father have been worried sick about you. We've had news reports of RAF fighting over the Channel, and there was no word from you."
"Sorry about that. We weren't allowed to use the telephone during the evacuation, and it's all right. I wasn't flying. Well, I was, but not on ops. Where is everyone?"
Maisie realized it would fall to her to break the news to Tom about his brother, his bravery, and how he now carried the wounds of war. She told Tom the story from beginning to end, and then answered his questions one after the other in quick succession, revealing his fear and concern.
"I'll put in for compassionate leave. I can't stay here flying all over the place like some gnat without a purpose. I'm coming home."
"Wait until you've spoken to your parents," said Maisie. "Tim will be at the hospital in Hastings for a few weeks, I'm sure. They have to wait to see if any infection emerges. Everyone's at Chelstone staying with me. It's not too far a drive to Hastings from there, and there's the train, too.
Can you fit in another if I can get away?
Of course I can, Tom. You'll have to bunk in with Tarkin, though.
For once I won't mind his snoring. I'll let you know when I'm coming, Tonty Maisie, but I'll try for Friday.
I hope to see you then, Tom, and do take care.
I'm up in Northumberland. Shouldn't really tell you that, should I? They put us pilots into three big groups and we're all over the place. There's us newish boys, who have to get our practice in, and then there's the next group, which is a mix, so everyone gets experience flying with more seasoned chaps, and then there are the pilots with the hours on them. They're a year or so older than me, the old salts. I started flying an old tiger moth, doing the sort of aerobatics that Uncle James would have done in the last war. I kept thinking of him, actually.
He paused for breath and to put more coins in the slot.
Then they put me on this American aeroplane called a Harvard. I thought it was a lovely kite, even had automatic wheels up. But now I'm really excited because the very good news is that I'm transferring to RAF Hawkins next month. They're moving me into Hurricanes. I'll have had about 10 or 12 hours flying by the time I'm on ops over to France, which isn't bad, as I think some of the men coming up after me will have less, what with one thing and another.
And Hawkins is in Kent, so you'll see something of me when I've a day or two off. Maisie nodded as if Priscilla's eldest son were in the room. Telephone your parents at the Dower House this evening. They should be there in an hour or so. Let them know you're doing well. They will be so relieved.
Will do, Tante Maisie. I want to know how my brother is. He'll get better when he knows I'm coming. The way this family is going, we'll make a good team of one-armed bandits. I'd better be careful.
Yes, you had. Now then, call your parents, and I'll see you at the week's end. You can tell me then what a one-armed bandit is. Maisie replaced the receiver, knowing that Tom's non-stop light banter at the end of the call was his way of assimilating his brother's plight, of trying to appear as if everything was normal. All the emotions that Priscilla and Douglas had experienced since they learned that Tim was missing would have hit Tom at once, with relief coming on top of fear and, she thought, some anger toward his sibling under the surface, in the place where deep brotherly love resided. Every member of the family was affected. That was how it was. And now Tom was being posted to RAF Hawking. Northumberland seemed a lot safer. "They're moving me into Hurricanes," Maisie shook her head. It felt as if they had all been moved into a hurricane, right into the eye of the storm. She went into the kitchen, took a bottle of white wine from her new refrigerator, she still had not become used to the intermittent running noise, and poured herself a glass. She stood for a moment, looking out the kitchen window across the garden, to her clematis still in bud, and then to the barrage balloons in the sky. Soon, she would have to think about closing the doors and drawing the blackout curtains. She thought of Tim, looking back at his homecoming, the image of him being taken from the boat on a stretcher, and the terrible wounds to his arm. And she remembered the description Sylvia Preston, the WAAF, had given her, of driving her ambulance onto Salisbury Plain and picking up the bodies of young men who had failed their first parachute jump. She pictured Tom, stationed at an aerodrome in Kent, which, it now seemed, would be on the front line of the invasion, if it came. And then Anna. Anna. How could she ever keep her safe? She sighed. Her heart was heavy. It was time for the next call. She had no need to look up the number before dialing.
McFarlane?
The greeting was as brusque as ever. Robbie, when will you answer the telephone as if there's a human being on the other end of the line and not a charging bull elephant? Said Maisie. Robert McFarlane, formerly a senior officer with Scotland Yard's special branch, and now working with the Secret Service as a linchpin between the two, laughed when he heard Maisie's voice.
That's been a while.
has it not, hen? And to what do I owe this intrusion into my first wee dram of the day?
Bit late for you, isn't it, Robbie? From my garden the sun is already over the yard arm.
I'm amending my ways, replied MacFarlane. That sounds almost poetic, doesn't it? Now then, seeing as you didn't mention taking me out for a nice four-course luncheon tomorrow, I take it this is a business call.
It is, yes.
Come on then. Tell me what's going on.
I could be wrong, Robbie, but I think I know of the whereabouts of an enemy agent. And even if he's not German, I think he's someone who's probably not on our side.
I see. Pray tell,
said Robbie. His tone now weighted with the gravity of her news. Maisie described her fears and her reservations. I just didn't think it was wise to wait any longer to tell you.
No, you're right there. I'll get on it. Don't go into your office tomorrow, and keep those two employees of yours out of the way.
Yes, I'll telephone them both immediately. She paused, curling the telephone cord around the fingers of her left hand. Robbie, he's a nice man. Go easy on him.
If the creeping vines are innocent, he won't even know we've been there. I'll put my little wee white gloves on for him.
But not your white boxing gloves. There was silence on the line before MacFarlane spoke again.
My nephew didn't get out of Dunkirk, Maisie.
I'm so sorry, Robbie. Truly I am, but please remember I could be wrong about the man.
I know you, Maisie, so in my gut I doubt it. Now then, stay away tomorrow. Treat yourself to an outing. Go home to the country to see that little girl of yours.
Maisie was grateful for a chill in the air as she walked along the embankment toward Scotland Yard. Having confirmed that Sandra would not be required in the office, she had arranged to meet Billy outside the police headquarters at 9:30 and instructed him not to go to the office first, as she had just remembered that some essential plumbing work would be in progress. She had slept little the previous night. Priscilla had called late in the evening to let her know that Tim was weak but improving, and had been awake long enough to talk briefly about Gordon's death. He had become distressed and was given a sedative. Andrew Dean had paid another visit and estimated that it would be another 2 weeks before Tim would be discharged. He counselled against Tim returning to London, as fresh air and the chance to begin walking each day would help with balance and well-being. Priscilla and Douglas would therefore be looking for a property to rent in Kent, and ideally as close to the village as possible.
We're family, Maisie. We all need to be near those we love, don't you think?
At Scotland Yard, Caldwell took Maisie's statement, starting with the day Phil Coombs came to her office to talk to her about his son.
Do you think the man knew about his brother-in-law and a paint at that point?
Said Caldwell.
He knew what sort of man Jimmy Robertson was. He knew he was a criminal, but remember, they had served together, had gone over the top into battle together. They were connected by the horrors they'd seen and by the fact that they both came home. I believe that as time went on, and of course Phil married Sally Robertson, Phil did his utmost to turn a blind eye to the way Jimmy Robertson operated. And Robertson looked after the family, providing many little extras that make life easier. I believe Phil at some point began to doubt Jimmy, and he had to face up to the reality that the man is very dangerous indeed. He couldn't go straight to Jimmy about Joe, because he knew deep down that Jimmy cared only about number one. So he came to me. Phil Coombs came to me only to say he was worried about his son, and if I found Joe safe and well, all to the better. But if not, then there was a detachment. It wouldn't be Phil who shopped Jimmy, it would be me. If luck held, Joe would come back, everyone would keep their mouths shut, and life would go on.
And as far as Phil and Sally Coombs were concerned, Jimmy had done more than provide those little extras I mentioned. He made sure both Archie and Joe were in reserved occupations. Vivian did well for herself, but there was always pressure to do anything she could for Uncle Jimmy, and that was probably true of the whole family. Caldwell nodded. Maisie thought she had never seen him look so drawn.
Detective Inspector Murphy has brought in the painting crew, and Freddie Mays has been charged with accessory to murder following his confession today. He was acting on the instructions of Jimmy Robertson, who, it transpires, showed his face, along with Mike Yates, at their lodgings in Whitchurch. They wanted Joe to be quiet about his headaches, and according to Yates, they told young Joe that it would be very bad form for his parents to know he wasn't pulling his weight in the job. We're getting enough to put Robertson away, and we hope for a long, long time. He has been brought in and is cooling his heels in a cell, though his brief is coming in to see him soon. The one who has had a fair bit of luck in allowing him to slide off our shovel in the past. Anyway, he's not been charged, but we have time. I just didn't want him to go anywhere. Not that getting away to the continent is a good idea at the moment.
I see. And what about the Bank of England?
Yes, that. All very interesting, I must say.
He shook his head and gave a satisfied chuckle.
Young Archie had what he thought was a bright idea when he went down to see his brother, and it came to his attention that there was money in the area, quite literally. He considered the possibilities and thought he might be able to make himself a lieutenant in his uncle's business if he had a potentially lucrative plan. He was scared of Robertson, but decided that if he could make himself more valuable, he'd be safer, and his opinions would carry more weight. He's admitted he tried to get Joe involved, but Joe didn't want to have anything to do with any cockeyed plans involving robbery. Now, Jimmy Robertson likes a good idea resulting in great sums of cash coming his way, as much as the next villain, but he also knows when it becomes a non-starter. He considered Archie's plan, looked at it from all angles, and then thought better of it.
It distracted me for a while, I must admit, though I always felt it might turn out to be important. My mistake, said Maisie.
Though it could end up being important, as another nail in Jimmy Robertson's coffin. We know he eventually dismissed the plans, but at first he couldn't ignore information about large sums of money going to and fro between London and Hampshire. Robertson and his boys were interested enough to put some quite detailed plans on paper and ask Archie to get more information before deciding the risks outweighed the benefits. And those incriminating papers were found in Archie's gaff, with Robertson's scrawl across every page, along with his signature because he loved his name so much. Bit of a narcissist, is Robertson, and those papers signify intention, which is important because he's been up for armed robbery more than once. So you might say they're a tool, and while we're about it, I've never known a lad of Archie Coombs's age to put so much into where he dosses down. This lad had his digs decked out like he was a matinee idol.
I think he just wanted something more out of life, said Maisie.
Don't we all? Replied Caldwell.
They discussed the revenue Robertson and Yates had brought in from the business of painting commercial buildings with the diluted fire retardant, and the fact that most were owned by people coerced into agreeing to the work by Robertson. The racket amounted to a pretty sum for the Robertson coffers. Maisie made a further statement, recounting how she had witnessed two lorries unloading and reloading stores on a country road close to the aerodrome where Teddy Wickham was stationed. It was not firm evidence, but enough to support deeper investigation. At the point where Caldwell began to shuffle his pages of notes, with only a few more questions left for Maisie to answer, there was a knock at the door, and a uniformed policeman entered.
"Oh, sorry, Gov, didn't know you had a visitor," said the policeman. "I thought you'd finished taking a statement in one of the interview rooms and was back up here on your own." "I can take a statement here where Miss Dobbs is concerned,"
She's one of our special advisers.
I'm just going round collecting for DC Abel, sir, to send something to his mum and dad. They're having a memorial service at their local church, and a few of the lads are going, especially on account of his dad.
Caldwell took out his wallet at the same time Maisie reached for her purse. The sergeant thanked them for their contributions and left the room.
"Abel's dad is in the force, you know," said Caldwell. "He was on the beat, but is now a desk sergeant out in Essex. I was told he always wanted his son to follow in his footsteps, so of course he was really chuffed when young Abel came to work at the yard. It had been his ambition when he was a lad, but he never quite made it out of the village. I bet he wishes his boy had stayed here."
"Yes," said Maisie. "Yes, I'm sure he does." Epilogue. Billy was waiting, pacing back and forth along the embankment, when Maisie came out of Scotland Yard.
"All right, miss, I suppose that's that. It seems they've got Jimmy Robertson cornered, though I must say that flying squad bloke looks more like a bit of a villain himself. No wonder they call him the Sweeney Todd."
"It's getting into the criminal mind that does it," said Maisie.
"But you don't look like a criminal. Well, not all the time."
Billy grinned, pleased with his quip.
"Thank you very much," said Maisie.
"How's your Billy getting on?"
"I forgot to tell you. He's been given another 9 days' leave by the docs. They reckon he needs extra time to get over that shoulder, and then he'll be right as rain. They don't want blokes with one shoulder up and one shoulder down on the parade ground, and to be honest with you, I think another week or two at home will do him good. Mind you, it's going to take longer than a few weeks for him to get over what he saw in France, and don't I know it."
"Then take the week off, Billy. It's time you had a holiday. There's no need to come into the office."
"But what about the work? We've got new business to consider."
"Make your calls, tell the clients that you are recommencing investigations in a week or so. There's no need to go to Fitzroy Square."
"What about you?"
"I'm taking a week to myself too, perhaps more. I've work to do to bring the case to a proper close, but I don't need to go into the office. And I've to see Robert McFarlane this afternoon. Then I'm going down to Shelstone. Sandra knows not to come in, so that's all right. We could all do with some time away." Billy looked at Maisie, raising his hand to shield his eyes from the morning sunshine.
"What's going on, miss?"
"Nothing more than me deciding that we could all do with a little holiday."
"Right then."
Billy sighed.
"I'm off home."
He patted the pocket where he kept his notebook.
"Got everything I need here, so I'll keep them security cases ticking over, and I'll spend that time with my family. Bobby's off to his Air Force Engineering College soon, and there won't be many more opportunities for us all to be together. Thank you, miss."
Maisie watched as Billy walked away, a spring in his step compensating for a war wound limp. She turned to walk toward Whitehall. She had no fixed appointment with Robbie McFarlane, but throughout the meeting with Inspector Caldwell at Scotland Yard, she was thinking of the report she had made the previous evening, and was curious to know the outcome. McFarlane would be back in his office by the time she arrived. Entering the building, she was about to approach a security guard when two young women came down the long flight of stairs to her right. The sound of their footfall and voices distracted Maisie, mainly because they were conversing in French.
"Eleanor?"
The woman who had been the nanny to Priscilla's sons only just managed to disguise her shock at seeing Maisie.
"Hello, Miss Dobbs."
She held out her hand, turning to her friend.
"This is my former employer's neighbour, Miss Dobbs."
The friend, who was dressed in the uniform of the first aid nursing yeomanry, as was Eleanor, turned to Maisie and smiled.
"How do you do? I'm very pleased to meet you."
"And you?" said Maisie. She was about to comment on how surprised she was that their paths should cross here, when Eleanor stemmed any further conversation.
"We're in rather a hurry, Miss Dobbs," said Eleanor.
Do give my best to Mrs. Partridge."
Maisie watched the women leave, then brought her attention to the security guard and stated her business. The guard turned to the telephone at his station and picked up the receiver. Half a minute later, he called out to Maisie, who had begun pacing back and forth along the tiled floor.
"Mr. McFarlane says you know the way. He's ready to see you in his office."
Maisie made her way along the labyrinthine corridors until she saw McFarlane waiting for her in the corridor outside his office. He waved as she approached and held open the door for her.
"Sit yourself down, lass," said McFarlane.
He was a tall, heavy-set man indeed. Maisie always thought he appeared less than comfortable seated at a desk. His bulk was more suited to movement, or a much more forgiving chair than those found in government buildings. McFarlane cleared his throat, as if preparing his deep Scottish burr for oratory.
"Following his arrest early this morning, the early bird catches the worm, as the saying goes. We've been interviewing your Mr. Walter Miles for several hours now, and look at this pile of notes I've amassed already."
He tapped a thick sheaf of papers on the desk.
"We might run out of paper with this case, and that's not an exaggeration. What with shipping affected by the war, even the daily newspapers are worried about supplies."
He cleared his throat.
"As you suspected, the blooming clematis was not a clematis after all. Well, it was, but it was a very good fake. Its true purpose was as an aerial to connect wireless transmissions. Very nicely tucked away, too. Frankly, we knew there was someone in the area up to funny business with a set, but we couldn't locate him. His English is perfect, but he's a German citizen, true name of Walter Meyer. So he wasn't far off with his invented identity. Always best to stick to a name you know, if you're an agent. And he was also a lecturer at the university, so that bit was right. He was a botanist, originally, but more recently he taught physics, and had been doing so for a year, took the place of another physicist, who is now working for the government. One of those boffins we've got tucked away, out in the country."
"I see," said Maisie.
"Not sure if you do quite yet, because there's more."
"Go on."
"It seems our Walter had a chip on his shoulder, and you were a way he could get rid of it."
"Me? Now you've lost me, Robbie."
"It's like this. You're upper classes, of which I could say you are one, though we both know your roots ran deep the other way. But as I was saying, your upper classes, until fairly recently, were used to embarking on a very expensive round of travelling known as the Grand Tour. When they reached a certain age, of course, off they went, around the castles and estates of Europe, on something of an aristocratic pub crawl. Bavaria, Rome, Florence, Paris, all very nice if you've got the wherewithal."
He rubbed his forefinger and thumb together. "What are you getting at?"
"Turns out that Walter was born out of wedlock, though his mother married eventually, but to a man without the funds his true father would have had to spoil him. I tell you, that Walter is holding nothing back now. The man is throwing his whole life story at us."
McFarlane cleared his throat.
"But if his beloved mother had been a satisfactory match for his sire, then his name would have been Compton."
"No, I can't believe it. Not Lord Julian."
"Don't be daft, lass. Even I know your father-in-law is too much of a gentleman to get himself into that sort of pickle. Mind you, his brother was less than careful with regard to the family's reputation, and on this tour went about sowing his wild oats."
"His brother? His brother died over 45 years ago or thereabouts. I don't know much about him. In fact, I can't remember anyone even mentioning him to me before I was married." Maisie was thoughtful. "But now I remember James telling me his late uncle was something of a dilettante. Lady Rowan apparently could not abide him. His name was Rupert."
and he died in a hunting accident in Bavaria.
Ah, but Rupert the Spare, the one the old lord and lady had just in case the heir Julian died, had impregnated a little fräulein at some point on that very excursion.